Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. A little over a century ago, Bethlehem Steel chartered the Dundalk Company and purchased 1,000 acres of land to build housing for workers. Today, the Dundalk Historic District is part of the National Register of Historic Places, and this company town is an important example of early 20th century community planning. Joining me to talk about how this development came to be is Amy Menzer, Executive Director of Dundalk Renaissance, a 20-year-old nonprofit community development organization. She also serves as a board member of the Friends of Maryland's Olmsted Parks and Landscapes. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also with us is Meg Fairfax Fielding, past president of the Baltimore Architecture Foundation. She heads the History of Maryland Medicine at MedCHI, the State Medical Association. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you very much.
Amy, World War I spurred the development of Dundalk. What was the goal?
So Bethlehem Steel purchased the Sparrows Point Steel Mill just before the United States entered World War I. And their focus was on trying to create a more appealing community for some of their workforce, which was at about 8,000 in 1917. And to bring employees closer to the steel plant, but not be right on top of the steel plant, and really develop a different kind of company town that would help reduce worker turnover, probably also reducing labor strife, increase quality of life, reduce commuting times on the streetcar. The cost of the streetcar was about 10 cents from Highland Town at the time, and it was only 5 cents from Dundalk.
And this was also a unique foray by the federal government into housing development, right?
Yes, it was really, as far as I understand it, it was in the research that I've looked at, it was the federal government's first foray into housing development. And they, the United States Shipping Board Emergency Fleet Corporation, commissioned 35 projects across the country. And there were only 2 housing developments in Maryland as part of that, and they were both in Dundalk. So that gives you a sense of how important the steel plant and shipbuilding right here were considered to the war effort.
Amy, this neighborhood was intended to be a place where managers and employees should live in proximity, but African Americans were barred from living there, correct? Where did African American employees in Bethlehem Steel live?
Correct. The town was developed by some of the same people that were involved in development of Roland Park and Guilford. They basically lifted the same racially restrictive covenants and put them in the Dundalk development. African Americans were confined to live in the Turner Station neighborhood, which is just south of where this historic area is.
Meg, there is sort of an urban legend that Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect behind Central Park in New York City, designed Dundalk. Fact or fiction?
It's pretty much fiction. I think initially people thought that was true. And in the intervening years between the time that somebody had written their master's thesis about it, it's pretty much been disproved.
Is there an Olmsted connection?
Amy, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so it's kind of like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. It's 1 degrees of Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. There were just a number of colleagues of Olmsted's that were directly involved in the development, including Edward Boughton, who was the manager at the Roland Park Company and also manager of the Dundalk Company. Olmsted was involved with Roland Park. There's several points of intersection, but it's all through colleagues and other projects.
Meg, you are a particular fan of Edward Palmer, who was a resident architect for the Roland Park Company.
He was. He worked for them from 1907 to 1917, and he designed a number of houses in Roland Park, including his own, which was modeled on a Swiss chalet. In addition to working at for Roland Park, he also had a small private practice. And in 1917, he opened his own firm. And one of the first commissions he got was to design the village for Dundalk, all the ship streets.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Meg Fairfax Fielding, past president of the Baltimore Architecture Foundation, and Amy Menzer, head of the community development corporation Dundalk Renaissance. We're talking about the history and design of historic Dundalk. Meg, what are the characteristics of city garden style that we see in Dundalk? Where else can this style be seen around Baltimore?
You know, Roland Park, Tuscany, Canterbury, some of the smaller neighborhoods, original Northwood, they're all these neighborhoods where the green is as important as the houses are. So it's not a long grid of row houses, but the streets meander and wind, and the trees and the plantings are as important as anything else.
Amy, what facets of the city garden style are still visible in Dundalk today?
Well, the essential plan of the community is all still pretty much intact. And, you know, a key feature of a Garden City town plan design is trying to integrate housing, green space, but also a town center, having shopping nearby. And then also the idea was you'd also have industry in its particular spot. And so in historic Dundalk, you have a town center that's really charming, and it's flanked by two parks and then ringed by several different neighborhoods of homes and intersected by transit.
And how have the homes and neighborhoods of Old Dundalk and Dunlogan changed?
All neighborhoods change, and, you know, as the original residents have passed on and the homes have changed hands, there's less cohesion in terms of who's there, the age of the homeowners, et cetera. So there are fewer people in each house, in each household, occupying the homes. You know, the whole community has become, you know, much more diverse racially and ethnically, and that's definitely a real opportunity for Dundalk as we look ahead and work to attract the next generation. We also have older residents that are continuing to age in place, and we work to support them. So, you know, the needs and issues have changed. There isn't, you know, 40,000, there aren't 40,000 jobs nearby that people can easily commute to, but the neighborhood still has a lot of appeal.
When did it come that African-Americans were able to live in Dundalk?
You know, I suspect it just had to do with desegregation in general. I don't think there was any specific date. You know, Dundalk is not an incorporated municipality. Nobody was regulating anything in a formal way. There were these restrictive covenants. And so when those were struck down by the courts, that would have been the point when it was legally possible for African-Americans to buy in Dundalk.
And of course, part of the changes over the years, steel construction went through different booms and busts over the decades. How did that affect the town?
Over the years, and even in the early development of the historic Dundalk area, that affected things. You know, the initial plan was to sell the homes to the workers. And then there was an immediate post-war decline in production that, you know, the steel plant all came close to shutting down. And so their workers couldn't buy the homes at that moment. So there have been ebbs and flows over the years. Obviously, with World War II, there was a tremendous boom and further expansion and development of the greater Dundalk area, which has, you know, close to 64,000 people, 24,000 households at this point. And then, you know, with the steel mill declining since the 1970s and finally closing in 2012, that has definitely affected things. But I would say over the decades, the variety of places where people in this community work have also shifted. And so while it was definitely there, it definitely affected the community and a number of folks who still live here. The steel mill shutting down did not shut down the community.
Meg, what stands out to you about the style of the homes?
The houses are pretty unique. They all have steeply pitched roofs. They're stucco. There were four basic designs used throughout the neighborhood, and the houses are not technically row houses. They're in groups of three or four, so there's space between the houses, so that's where you get your green space. The roof lines are slightly different in each house. They're gable roofs or jerkin head, which is a sort of clipped off pitched roof, or shed shaped, or Palmer's favorite shape was sort of a flared roof at the bottom of the roof line. But they're all stuccos, so they have some commonality. They've changed a lot because there were no restrictions on what you could do with your house later on, unlike some of the other Palmer developments. So there are a lot of different colors now. So even though they're all stucco, there's a lot of variety in them. And they've been renovated and added to significantly.
Where else in our area can we see homes designed by Edward Palmer?
Roland Park, Homeland, Guilford, Dumbarton in Baltimore County, not Dumbarton in Rogers Forge, but Dumbarton by Pikesville. And then if you want to see a similar neighborhood, Wawaset in Wilmington, Delaware, was designed by Palmer for DuPont for their executives and scientists. So it's very similar to Dundalk, but for the higher level workers, and they're more single family homes than that. They're duplexes and again, sort of these three or four houses together. And that neighborhood had very strict covenants on what owners could do with their houses. So it's virtually intact, and it's about an hour and a half up the road. So if anybody wants to see a great little neighborhood of all Palmer and Lambden, that's the place to go.
Amy, let me pick up on what you said about supporting residents. You lead the nonprofit Dundalk Renaissance. How is it working to support the town's future?
We have seen a tremendous amount of success as new residents move to the area and, you know, are struck by the beauty and charm of a lot of the historic district area, as well as the broader Greater Dundalk area, and it's, you know, access to waterfront and parks and affordability. So we are attracting new residents, and then we're also working to support current residents, whether they're homeowners, and we're helping them stay and reinvest in their homes with renovation loans. We also have a senior home repair program that supports seniors to age in place, and that's a partnership with Baltimore County and several other nonprofits. We have done an energy retrofit grant program to increase the energy efficiency of the homes. And then we do a number of programs to strengthen our businesses in that historic Dundalk Town Center. We have pop-up shops. We, you know, support the businesses with facade improvement grants. We've had a sizable amount of COVID relief funds, thanks to the state of Maryland, to be able to offer to businesses to keep them afloat during this challenging year.
One could study the history of Dundalk or Baltimore or any town without focusing on the architecture or the planners and the designers. Amy, what do we learn by examining history through that lens?
If you come to Dundalk and walk through the historic district, it is quite striking that, this is not a gridiron street plan. There are curving streets that take advantage of, you know, the natural hills that were here and create these sort of scenic vistas, which is a very sort of Olmstedian kind of thing to do. And as Meg had mentioned, the steep pitch of the roofs and the stucco, it has a very charming English village style feel to it. Even though some of the homes have been modified, I can tell you over the years and the homes that we have renovated and worked with homeowners to renovate, most of the homes are still fairly similar inside and out to probably what they were initially. So there's a lot here that's retains that feel. And it's useful to understand that in the sense that it's a very different approach to providing housing for the working class from a row home neighborhood that is more typical in most of Baltimore, Philadelphia, and other parts of Dundalk.
Thank you both for this conversation. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Amy Menzer is Executive Director of Dundalk Renaissance. Meg Fairfax Fielding is past president of the Baltimore Architecture Foundation and the head of the History of Maryland Medicine at MedChi. You can hear more about the birth of historic Dundalk in 5 weeks on July 9th at a virtual event hosted by the Baltimore Architecture Foundation and Baltimore Heritage in concert with the Maryland chapter of the American Society of Landscape Architects and the Friends of Maryland's Olmsted Parks and Landscapes. We have a link at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Quick break here. I'm Sheila Cast. When we're back, a Stoop story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.